ideas. Music. 2SER 107.
Welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station all around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
Ultimately, it's going to be a sad loss to China in a very sort of power-driven, very punitive response to democracy.
Zhu Xiangrun, a rare outspoken critic of the government in China's heavily censored academia, was arrested in Beijing yesterday, and further arrests will continue to be made in Hong Kong as China clamps down further on the former Crown colony. Also on the program...
I think it's really upsetting to me that a young black journalist or young culturally diverse journalist feel scared to enter the media.
Following the inherent prejudice experienced by SBS journalist Cody Bedford, which she chronicled on Twitter recently, we look at underlying racism and discrimination in the media in Australia. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, Victoria's second wave of COVID-19 transmissions continued to rise today with 191 new cases reported. The news comes in the wake of orders to close the busiest national border between Victoria and New South Wales by midnight tonight. With 55 formal border crossings, state and federal health and security services are scrambling to meet this ballooning threat. We take a look at the progress on the one solution that we may have. And we take a look at the progress made on the one solution to COVID-19. When will we get a vaccine? Ryan Stanton has the details.
According to recent reports, Victoria has recorded 191 new COVID-19 cases today, the highest they've reported since the pandemic began. This spike, according to Brendan Coates, Household Finances Program Director at the Grattan Institute, was due to a combination of shortcomings in quarantine procedures and a lack of zero transmissions before easing restrictions. For Coates, this surge in transmissions highlights an important lesson.
Well, I think what we've seen is the value of that elimination strategy in the states that have managed to achieve it. So there was a debate at the time about whether we should go for a harder lockdown for a shorter period to eradicate COVID from Australia. And that option was not really taken up. Instead, states largely went for what's called a suppression strategy, where you try to flatten the curve and reduce the number of infections, and with the stated aim of suppressing the virus, and if you ended up with eradication by accident, then that's great. Now, what we've seen is in states that have eradicated COVID, life is largely returning to normal. Bars are open, cafes are open. You can have people at the football. You know, you're getting a lot of those economic costs from COVID have gone. For those states, though, where you still have cases, the right strategy is to be careful and cautious and try to get down to zero.
States like Victoria face a long road to elimination, according to Coates. Professor Michael Wallach, immunologist at the School of Life Sciences at UTS, agrees with this sentiment.
So it would be very much expected that peaks like these will flare up from time to time in different parts of the country. As you see, mistakes made in Melbourne in terms of keeping people in quarantine can quickly get out of control. So the key is to not panic and to rapidly deploy and rapidly deal with it. But we mustn't go and think that, you know, we've been through it, it's over, and we're going to be fine. We have to maintain the social distancing and everything else that goes with it.
Professor Wallach also notes that living with the virus is a reality we must face, even with the potentiality of a vaccine in the future.
As you might have seen and has been reported in other countries where a lot of research is going on, like the U.S., we're not going to expect a vaccine that's going to eradicate the virus. Rather, what we're hoping for are vaccines and other approaches that are going to bring control to the virus. So we shouldn't just think that we're in a waiting stage until something's going to come along and save us all. Rather, we're going to have to think about ways in which we live with the virus. It's probably going to be present for a long time. And we've lived with influenza for hundreds of years. We're going to have to figure out ways and means by which we live together, not only through social distancing, but every other type of means that we have available to us. And vaccines will play a certain amount of role in that, but it won't be perfect and it won't solve the problem completely unless we're extremely lucky. But we certainly can't count on that.
With the possibility of a vaccine a ways off, and not the magic bullet that some might expect, many may be asking how COVID will affect everyday life going forward. For Coates, this once again comes down to the strategy used.
If you aim for elimination, you actually eliminate from Australia, and we tighten up the quarantine arrangements so that it is the use of PPE, personal protective equipment is being properly used, security guards and or police, as they probably take over the quarantine, are acting very carefully and cautiously, then you could probably be in a world where you could largely open things back up once you know that COVID is gone. If we don't do that, then we're likely to see renewed outbreaks like what we've seen in Victoria from time to time. They may not be as large as what's happening in Victoria, but it does mean we'll, in certain places at certain times, see restrictions reintroduced to get on top of infections.
For Professor Wallach, meanwhile, the key once again lies in adapting and learning to live with the virus.
The government strategy definitely is towards total control and perhaps aiming for eradication. It seems unlikely that we'll achieve such a goal. And again, to sit around and wait for a vaccine for what could be years has severe economic implications. So what I would say is that what needs to be put in place sooner rather than later as the vaccines become available and whatever other drugs and other types of therapeutic approaches, a really clear strategy has to be made. How do we get out of this sort of lockdown that the country's in? Even though we can go out and be with each other, we're really controlling the borders to an extent that the economy is severely affected. So as I said earlier, I think it's coming up with a strategy in which we can live with the virus and maintain control without completely isolating ourselves from the rest of the world. That's the key.
Professor Michael Wallach, immunologist at the School of Life Sciences, University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report by Ryan Stanton.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
The Chinese government passed new legislation on the 30th of June criminalising acts of secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion with foreign forces. The law allows for secret trials and trials without jury and life sentences as a maximum punishment for those found guilty. Critics say this law infringes upon Hong Kong's autonomy and liberty and the basic law. Bageshri Saviasachi asked law expert Bruce Bear-Arnold to explain why China has brought this in now.
What we see is Beijing, so People's Republic of China, doing a radical, overreaching crackdown on civil liberties in Hong Kong and claiming to extend that crackdown to the rest of the world.
And what does it mean for the nature of separate jurisdiction in Hong Kong? Are the lines between mainland and the region being blurred?
It's basically getting rid of the distinction between the special administrative region and the rest of China. So for practical purposes, Beijing is replacing law in Hong Kong. Most importantly for people in Australia, Beijing is purporting to extend that law to Australia, to basically to anywhere in the world, making it a criminal offence to criticise the government in Beijing. So this is wildly, wildly ambitious. It's contrary to international law, but it will certainly frighten, silence a number of people who, say, live in Australia but want to go to Hong Kong, want to go to the rest of China.
And when you said practical purposes, what would you say is the reasoning for this law to be introduced by the CCP?
Well, for a number of reasons. One, Beijing wants great control over Hong Kong. They're worried that, if you like, the flourishing of democracy in Hong Kong will bleed into the rest of China. They're trying to get rid of an example of civil disobedience. And I think just as importantly, the law here is being driven by internal politics, power politics within Beijing. So at the highest levels of the party, where we have leaders jostling to prove that they're tough, they're effective, that they should be entrusted with more power. So it's just as much a matter of, of sort of inner party politics as it is of crushing democracy in Hong Kong.
Do you think this would cause a new refugee situation in the special administrative region?
It's not clear. I think there will certainly be a large number of people, often very talented people, wanting to leave. But many people in Hong Kong have already been trying to get out, making arrangements, looking long term. So in some instances, we're talking medium to small sized business people. We're also talking students, and we're talking scholars. We're talking legal practitioners. So my experience, I've been approached a number of times by people I consider to be talented, the sort of people that we would want to live in Australia, encouraged to live in Australia. They're looking ahead. They've seen the writing on the wall. They've anticipated this sort of crackdown would occur. And they're thinking about getting out. And it's a great loss to China. Potentially, it's a great benefit to Australia, because we will get smart, diligent, well-educated, entrepreneurial people, the sort of people that we want in Australia.
And how do you think the Australian government is responding to this new law?
Yeah, well, we're seeing fairly contradictory policies within Australia. Australia tends to talk about human rights, talk about justice, but in terms of international politics, is very much concerned with China as a major trading partner. Is also trying to square the circle in terms of aligning Australia with the US. So on the one hand, we're saying human rights are really important. On the other hand, we're saying that money is very, very important, more important. So we're, in terms of policy, we're all over the place.
Do you have anything else to add with regards to this new law and its implications?
I think we're going to see some continued creativity. One of the things that we certainly see with Hong Kong is that many people there are really smart. They're very talented, and they will quite energetically subvert the system. They will use humour. They will protest. They will protest in a number of ways, and we will see Beijing continue to crack down in a rather heavy-handed way that will ultimately discourage creativity, discourage investment, entrepreneurship. Ultimately, it's going to be a sad loss to China in a very sort of power-driven, very punitive response to democracy.
Bruce Baer-Arnold, Assistant Professor of Law at University of Canberra, speaking with Bageshri Saviasachi. This is The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia. And hello if you're listening in Canberra on 2XX, or on the Bellinger River on 2BBB, or on 2Bob Radio in Taree. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're seeing what has been described as a viral reckoning, a push for increased diversity in Australia's newsrooms. Several journalists have spoken out, addressing their own experiences of bias in the workplace. Former SBS journalist Cody Bedford was amongst them as she chronicled her experiences at the broadcaster on Twitter. Bedford said she faced humiliation, was mocked for her accents, was joked about, and was always introduced as an Indigenous cadet journalist. Hannah Kwan asked former NITV Indigenous journalist Madeline Heyman-Reba how she would advise young people entering the media to cope with underlying prejudice.
I think it's really upsetting to me that a young black journalist or a young culturally diverse journalist feel scared to enter the media, or they just don't have a high expectation of what they can do and who they can become because they've heard these stories. I think the best thing is the fact that we're talking about it, because now we can all work together to change things.
Several people, including former SBS journalist Cody Bedford, have chronicled their experiences with racism at broadcasters and in the Australian media sphere online. Bedford said that she faced humiliation, was mocked for her accent, jokes were made about alcoholism towards her, and she was always introduced as the Indigenous cadet journalist. And I was wondering, as a journalist yourself, what was your response to this, and what has been your experience in newsroom environments?
So I think that for the most part, when I first saw Cody's tweets, I wasn't shocked at all. I was really upset on her behalf. I was so proud of her for actually speaking out about it, because this isn't something new. This has been going on for so long. And I guess Indigenous journalists feel like they can't speak out about it a lot of the time. So it takes a lot of guts to do that. And I think one of the big reasons why she was able to feel like she could do that is because we have such a strong community, and also because she is no longer a journalist.
You mentioned that more people are speaking out increasingly now, and you've mentioned that people have spoken out before, but why do you think this is gaining such traction now?
I think it has a lot to do with the Black Lives Matter stuff that's been happening recently, to be honest. I think people feel a lot more supported and stronger and feel empowered to be able to speak out and say these things, and know that they're not going to get the same backlash that they may have, you know, a few years ago.
And there's also been some debate, and a former SBS managing director, Michael Abid, recently said in a Sydney Morning Herald article that white people can do those stories when it comes to reporting on multicultural issues. I was wondering, as a journalist yourself who's reported extensively on Indigenous issues, what would be your response to a statement like that?
Well, I just think, as an Aboriginal woman, as well as being an Indigenous journalist, I think that that's wrong, because there's nothing like lived experience. With all due respect to those amazing journalists out there, if you don't live in community or you don't have any association with community other than what you do at work, then that's not the same, and you can't tell the story in the same way as you can being a Black journalist.
And also, in that same vein, news organisations like the ABC and SBS have come under fire recently for having only white people in their highest leadership roles. How important is it to have diversification and sort certain hiring incentives when it comes to those roles?
I think it's critically important, because the people who are in those roles, they're going to bring more culturally diverse people into roles as they grow too. And that's going to give different perspectives on the way that things are reported and the way that things are talked about and the way that the media landscape is influenced in that sense.
Why do you think this is such a divisive issue?
I wouldn't say it's too divisive anymore from what I'm seeing. I think a lot of people are it's more eye-opening to a lot of people, and they're starting to realise and address these issues.
What do you think people can do, and what do you think a solution is, if there is one?
I think that it's just about listening, learning, appointing, supporting our younger Black and culturally diverse journalists in their jobs, the people who are already in the industry, putting them into positions of leadership where they have editorial control as well. That's really important.
Madeleine Heyman-Reber, former NITV journalist, ending that report by Hannah Kwan.
The Wire, independent news and current affairs for the last 15 years and still going strong.
The government is considering banning the popular social media app TikTok. It comes amid increased concern over data security and foreign influence in Australia. River McCrossan has more.
It's a video app used by 1.6 million Australians that's seen a surge in users dancing and miming their way through coronavirus lockdown. But according to Melbourne paper The Herald Sun, it's turning heads in Canberra.
We're very concerned about foreign interference in social media.
The app is owned by Chinese company ByteDance, which has some worried Australian data may end up in foreign hands. TikTok user Abby Hansen, whose account has almost 30,000 followers, says she isn't one of them.
I don't know if it's naive for me to say. I'm not an expert on the matter, so I don't really know how much worth my comment has, but I think like the horse has already sort of bolted, especially with the whole use of Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that. We've already been handing it over to other people for a long time.
However, Ms. Hansen says she is concerned about what she says is censorship on the platform.
They like to censor, you know, the protests that were happening in Hong Kong or, you know, protests that were happening in America with Black Lives Matter. At the height of all the protests concerning, like, George Floyd in America, there was, you know, in my TikTok feed, it was just every single video was a video of people that were at protests and, you know, they were filming police brutality. They were also filming peaceful protesters and showing people that what was being shown on the news was really not the case at all a lot of the time. And then basically just within a matter of a few days, that content would then just be removed completely. And a lot of the users or the TikTok creators, as they'd call them, were being shadow banned and, yeah, they were all sort of like asking, where's our content gone? Where's it all gone? So
putting our users' safety and their privacy first is something we're focused on every day.
TikTok Australia manager Lee Hunter.
TikTok would never share any user information with any foreign government, including the Chinese government.
Cybersecurity expert Professor Greg Austin says that is little assurance.
He was responding to the specific question of whether the Chinese government accesses it through some sort of normal, regular and open process. But user data on most internet applications is accessible by the United States government and the Chinese government through cyber espionage.
The Herald report cited an unnamed federal MP saying the government was considering banning the platform. Professor Austin.
Because you might as well ban all of the foreign equipment in Australian wireless modems throughout the country. So, for example, many of the wireless modems throughout Australia are supplied by Huawei. So it's quite a silly process to think about banning everything simply because it's got a Chinese origin.
Professor Alston says individual Australians also need to take responsibility.
For example, I don't use Facebook and I never will for privacy reasons. In the same way that if you go into North Korea and you've got a phone or you go into China and you've got a phone, you would understand that the Chinese government or the North Korean government might be listening in. Well, we have to start to understand that as we live in Australia, those foreign governments already have the capability to collect our data.
The reported move follows increased concern over foreign interference as diplomatic tensions between Australia and China continue. Less than 2 weeks ago, Australia announced a $1 billion boost to cybersecurity, while earlier in June, the Prime Minister raised the alarm on state-based cyber attacks. But while Australia's security agencies have pointed the finger at Beijing, Professor Austin says China isn't the only player we need to look at.
I think the way forward is to stop being erotic and anti-Chinese about this sort of stuff and understand that security on these apps can be compromised by governments, many governments, not just the Chinese government. So people have to look after their own security and be aware of what they're sharing.
Cybersecurity expert at the University of New South Wales, Professor Greg Austin, ending the report from River McCrossan.
Reception isn't always the best out here in the bush. But if I miss The Wire, I listen to the podcast.
The Wire. Across Australia, weeknights on Indigenous and Community Radio. And now podcast.
And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or you can listen to our podcasts. Just search for The Wire and look for individual stories as well. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for The Wire Radio, all one word. The Wire is a team effort from 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide in Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or online weekdays. I'm going to be back again tomorrow, so please do tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. And in Sydney, produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.
Young hustler, don't move so fast. Young hustler, little gotta last. Young hustler, it comes, then it goes. Young hustler, best slow your roll, man. Young hustler, matriculate. Young hustler, life's more than cake, boy. Young hustler, mind motivate. Young hustler, don't slow your fate. Young hustler, street sing, a sweet lullaby. Fast life, flow fly, stay high.